Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 369.DE0419, certificate number 26731. The Dogon.
I'll name a famous alien, and you tell me whether Hollywood got their depiction right or oh so wrong. So we're going to call it Alien versus Giorgio. You ready?
Yep.
E.T.
Very good, yes. Very correct.
And what about aliens from the Alien franchise?
Hollywood. Entertainment.
The Coneheads.
Those Coneheads actually exist as bona fide
wow.
Archaeological artifacts.
And what about Jabba the Hutt?
Oh, Jabba, yeah. Well, he's, I better not talk about him.
Is this another Dungeons & Dragons episode?
Yes. The Dogon will reduce your armor class by 6 points every time it does one of its acid attacks.
I employ the Crown of Might.
The Dogon actually will involve monsters at some point.
Oh.
You're a believer in Little Green Men in the UFOs?
UFOs? Yeah, sure.
They come from Dimension X or whatever.
I like a lot of things that are supernatural or subnatural.
Subnatural?
I believe them. I believe in them and also don't believe in them.
I think I need to hear more about the difference between the supernatural phenomena and the subnatural ones. See, supernatural ones are beyond what we can see.
Right.
Subnatural ones are what? They're so lame that we can't see them?
That's exactly right. They're so believable that it boggles the mind.
So cryptozoology is just interested in the unlikely things. A dinosaur in Scotland,
right.
A gorilla man in the Cascades.
Right, some kind of a whale in a freshwater lake.
But what if there was something so usual that
right.
we never noticed it?
A rock in a field of rocks.
there's a ladybug, but it's got an extra spot or something.
Right. I mean, five-leaf clover, you mean. No, but that's exciting.
It's a two-leaf clover.
Yeah,
exactly. I found it. What do you think about... I feel like on the Omnibus before, we must have talked about the 70s fad of alien archaeology.
Oh, for sure.
All this Chariots of the Gods, Eric von Daniken kind of stuff about what if the UFOs weren't just coming to rural farmhouses now... What if they came to Sumeria and Mexico?
Well, that is a
thousands
I think
of
that,
years ago.
That 70s fashion spawned a whole subgenre of kook, didn't it? I mean, there are still ancient archaeology is what that or ancient ufologists, the guy with the crazy hair on the Discovery Channel that
sure.
thinks they built the pyramids,
right? Would Dan Aykroyd even be selling
crystal skull
booze
vodka.
Booze in crystal skull bottles,
yeah.
If not for these weird beliefs we have about... It just happens that when an unusual archaeological discovery gets made, often it gets filtered down several levels through pop culture until somebody with weird hair decides, nope, that was the ancient aliens.
Well, that the drawings down in the Atacama Desert and the ones that you see in England and various places that are only really... not visible from outer space, but only really sort of apprehendable from
right.
from high up.
The Nazca lines don't look like a big hummingbird
right.
unless you're a UFO coming in for orbit
right.
on runway 5.
I mean, that was all I needed to see to be convinced.
Once I read, when I was a kid, I read the Tintin book about this. Do you remember there's a Tintin book about ancient aliens?
I know everything about Tintin. We are surrounded by a Tintin library here.
I know there's no shortage of Tintin material in this house.
My little girl just the other day said, I have every Tintin book, except there's one about the Congo. and I like bowed my head in
her mom's
in mourning.
In the background doing the swiping across the neck sign to you. Yeah. Well, this actually, you know, African colonialism also comes into play in our story. It's your favorite things, D&D monsters,
yes,
and racist Belgians.
Amazing.
It's not. In this case, they're French and not Belgian. I don't know if that's better or worse.
I can never tell them.
There is a, among the many diverse tribes of West Africa, there's a people called the Dogon that live in southern Mali and the northern part of Burkina Faso, I guess what used to be Upper Volta.
I think you will find that if they live in Mali, they live in southern Mali.
The northern part is the Sahara.
Mali and Niger are both these big countries that when you examine the population, it's all clustered down around the fertile river.
Yeah. The Sahara Desert is like Coachella. There's a lot of Mali.
Oh,
come on.
Wow.
You're not happy with that at all.
Oh, no. That gave me a pain.
It's but you're right, they live south of the bend in the Niger River there,
right?
There's somewhere on the order of 500,000 Dogon people living in it's a big people and in a cluster of villages. 1,000 years ago they refused to convert to Islam, and generally there are not 500,000 left of people who refused to convert to Islam, but in this case it led to the development of their culture. They were able to keep their original beliefs and customs. And they moved to the high country, the sandstone cliffs of the Bandiagara Escarpment.
The Bandiagara Escarpment, you say?
Which sounds like a Tarzan plot device, but it apparently is actually some kind of central plateau in Mali. And so a lot of their villages are built defensively, you know, against whoever the new oppressors are, whether Arabs or colonial French or whoever. So they've got these amazing kind of Mesa Verde looking villages built into these sandstone cliffs. And, you know, some of these village clusters have thousands and thousands of people.
Now, the Mali is also the site of the Blue Men of the Sahara, the Tuareg.
That we entered into the omnibus earlier.
That's right. Mali and Niger seem to be fertile ground for people who have not embraced the other governments of Mali and Niger.
Maybe because, like you say, there's so much of it. It's so big. They can just wander into the desert, or in this case, into the cliffs of the escarpment.
Right.
And not be troubled by their sword or musket wielding newcomers.
Oh, but that we could do that here.
Also, I just wish all our newcomers here had, you know, all our potential invaders here just had swords and muskets.
Yeah, me too.
That would be a lot. That'd be a lot better. Living here on the West Coast within range of possibly North Korean missiles. As a result, the Dogon were able to preserve their culture for 1,000 years. It appears to be a culture largely based on harmony. They have elaborate rituals where they give each other compliments and thank and respect each other.
Oh, not musical harmony, but harmonious living.
Yes.
I was like, whoa, are they just living like in a, where you meet somebody on a trail and you just hit a note and
hello,
then they
hello,
take a
hello.
That'd be so great.
I don't know if they sing the words or not, but all their cultures were built, a lot of their customs are built around, you know, good feeling and getting along. And, there's a, you know, their days, if you were to hang out in a Dogon village, which is probably a pretty big if.
I love that. It's just that phrase, like hang out in a Dogon village.
You would just hear the same, you know, elaborate greeting exchange repeated, because when you meet someone, you there's a back and forth where you both say nice things about each other.
Oh, it's like a tea ceremony, but sure. It happens like 30 times a day.
Right. You're just walking down the street. You're just trying to buy your flatbread or whatever. And it's like, oh no, I got to do this again. I don't want to paint it out as some total Mr. Rogers culture.
Sure.
They also do female genital mutilation.
Sure,
and,
sure.
You know, the kind of stuff you'd expect. Less polygamy than you'd expect, but, you know, if you're menstruating, you got to go into a special bad person hut.
Right.
And they believe the clitoris to be a male part that must be removed unless you're a male. And conversely, you know, to be fair, they believe the foreskin is female and also must be removed. But that's not cool. You can tell that's a system invented by men. That's not
quite the same.
Not a fair tit for tat.
If they took everything from the foreskin
right.
on off the penis, then
with a rock and a sharp rock in the same way.
I don't think that you can survive and keep your culture completely discreet from your surroundings just by hiding in an escarpment. I think.
What if it's a really good escarpment?
I think you also need to be fairly warlike, or at least willing to beat some heads.
The kind of mental toughness you think it might take to.
You're going
to
need some mental toughness. I think you're going to need to hurt each other.
You sound
and
like
other
a
people.
Football coach defending a really hard hit, except in this case, the hard hit is being performed on hundreds of thousands of young women. So I don't know. But yeah, you're right. There's, you know, they're not necessarily a warlike people, but you're right. It's not all just sweetness right. and light.
I mean, I think that when they started doing cultural anthropology of the bonobos, and realized that instead of fighting, they just had sex with each other. Mm-hmm. That, at least for a while in my young years, that became a pop, like maybe a symbol of hope that maybe we could.
Like in your generation or just in your head?
No, in my generation.
We were just all having chimp sex.
Because I think that research coincided with a period in my life when I was in my early 20s. And so it sort of swept through alternative underground culture like, whoa, dude, this has been right in front of us all along. All we need to do instead of fight.
And it may have reinforced what many young men of your age were thinking, which is that science would eventually prove the beauty of promiscuity.
Of having sex all the time, right. And if particularly if it was a...
with a monkey.
An alternative to fighting.
Sure.
But I think since then we've always... since then, there's been a thread where any cultural anthropology is sort of looking for some secret to peace that involves maybe a stoning ceremony. That was what was so popular about that story.
The lottery,
Shirley Jackson. Right? Because the whole first three quarters of that book, you're like, wow, they've
what
got
a
it
great
all figured
town.
Out.
How did they do it? What's the secret?
Yeah.
Oh, right. They kill old lady whatever every year. But the bonobos don't. Nobody ever found the bonobos doing secret violence.
But the bonobos are...
Except consensual violence, maybe.
Bonobos are monkeys, not people. So the people always have to throw that extra wrinkle in where they... use a sharp rock on you.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned cultural anthropologists for whom everything looks like a nail if you have one hammer, mm-hmm. because this is the point where Marcel Griol enters our story.
Oh, almost the Frenchman or the Belgian?
He's a Frenchman.
Okay.
Almost everything we know about almost everything we knew about the Dogon for decades came from the work of Marcel Griol, who first traveled to southern Mali in the early 1930s to visit them. And essentially set up a base camp there and returned many times all the way through his death in the late 50s. And in fact, I think posthumous work was being published from his visits to the Dogon as late as the 1960s.
So Mali would have been within the greater territory of French West Africa.
Yes, it would not have been independent until, I don't even know, late 50s, early 60s? When is Malian independence? We don't celebrate that in my house.
Yeah, it would have
been. Which we should.
Been,
we live in Seattle. We should celebrate all the diverse African holidays.
Yeah, but like the independent, it's not a thing like Cinco de Mayo where Malian independence became a drinking holiday. So.
Why not? Let's all get really drunk on palm wine once a year in June. Oh, it's the 60th anniversary of this year. It was the late June 1960.
Yeah, that's right. And then a lot of those former territories formed a federation called the Mali Federation in 1960, 60-61.
It's always cool when you're the country that gets to keep the old name.
Right? The Oregon Territory.
Exactly.
It's like, what? We're not part of the Oregon Territory here in great old Washington.
We had to pick some like kind of Johnny-come-lately colonizer name because Oregon, the weird, possibly Native American name of dubious origin, was taken. So Marcel Griol spent decades with these people and published many times about what he took to be their complex and beautiful belief systems. The most elaborate of which came with 33 days that he spent in 1946 with a blind tribal elder and hunter named Ogo Temela. And a lot of his work takes the form of a dialogue between Ogo Temela and the Nazarene, which is what he calls himself. What? You don't think there should be messianic overtones to...
He called himself the Nazarene. I was like, when you said the Nazarene, I was like, who's the Nazarene?
Now we got an exciting new figure on the scene.
This is... It's him. Wow.
That's what Ogotemela calls him in the dialogue. Maybe he leaves out the part where he's like, hey, maybe just call me the Nazarene. I'm trying to get it going with some of the guys. Jacques won't do it, but...
You know, in my experiences in traveling in North Africa, I've had more than one people... Oh, I'm sorry. Not more than one people, more than one
Tuareg,
person.
The Tuareg, the Dogon.
More than one person, in the context of like a late night conversation about culture that you often find yourself in when you're traveling in foreign countries. I've had more than one person there call me Christian.
Really?
Like, well, listen, Christian, here's how we do it around here. And, you know, and when I would protest, like, well, now wait a minute. You know, don't just call me Christian.
Did you show them your new atheist writings?
I put my fedora on.
Let me explain to you Pastafarianism, sir.
When I would say like, well, now it's not as you can't reduce me and my whole culture to just Christians, and they laughed. I mean, they rejected that. They were like, no. I mean, we are Muslimmen, and you are Christians, and so. As the Christian here, you're gonna shoulder the weight of your.
It's
culture.
Definitely the kind of thing that seems, kind of, you know, not at all. It seems benign coming from the colonized people. Whereas if you were like, "Hey, Muslim, which way's the hostel?" Like, you know, it doesn't go so well the other direction.
I mean, and it is true when you think about it. Like, I'm the only Christian that they know or knew or had. I mean, potentially had met.
Maybe they thought your name was Christian. Maybe the first guy they met was like Christian Leitner. Were you wearing Christian Dior?
I was clearly not Christian. I mean, my name was clearly not Christian because I was wearing a sweatshirt that said John. Hi, I'm John. My mom made it for me.
You're one of the Mouseketeers. That's fantastic.
She makes me one every time I go traveling.
Maybe they were, you know, when we traveled as kids, my mom would always, she would not put our names on our shirts, but she would make us wear some kind of early 80s polo shirts.
Matching
of an unusual color. Because she had 3 to 4 children and she did not want them running off in the airport. And we didn't have the monkey leash backpacks yet.
You don't remember how many children she had?
3 to 4. My brother's kind of on the outs. No, it depends on where in our chronology this takes place.
Oh, I see.
What, you know, when.
Yeah, right.
There could have been 3 of us. There could have been 4 of us. But we were always had to wear like these bright purple... Ralph Lauren polo shirts.
Which is hilarious when you're 8, but awful when you're 15.
Well, think of the age range in some right. Mormon 80s family. There's a 13-year-old, an 11-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 3-year-old.
No. You'd better be able to break into harmony.
That's right. And we just sang Osmond's songs in the airport, and people threw money. What was I even talking about? Oh, right. Christian. They were calling you Christian. Do you think it was a mutiny on the Bounty bit? He was like,
no.
Mr. Christian?
Fully not.
That would have been my first thought. So they're calling him the Nazarene. And in these long dialogues, Ogotemela tells him secret knowledge, only known to initiates.
So these aren't Platonic dialogues where the Nazarene ends up being the all-knowing hero.
He's learning about the culture. It's not some Carlos Castaneda kind of a thing where this mysterious figure, I mean, it's presented a little more academically,
right?
But it takes the form of this. It was all this 133-day conversation where this guy said, let me break it down. Not everybody knows about this.
133-day conversation.
Well, they took breaks for food.
Well,
I love that so much.
It's just the idea of like, all right, let's sit down and get this.
Well, he had published before about their creation myths and about their belief systems. And the story changed a little bit every time. And this time he gets the full story, which is very different, I think, than what he had published back in the whenever he first published, 30s maybe. Mm-hmm. But it's a very elaborate story about a creator god named Amma who uses, you know, vibrations to create the spheres and the universe. But at some point, two twins get created, the Namo. These are water spirits of some kind. And there's a naughty one. The naughty Namo is called Ogo, but he's got a good twin.
Oh, the naughty Namo.
The naughty Namo is, we're actually deeply indebted to the naughty Namo because he's the one who created the Earth. Without Ogo, he creates space and time through his, he's maybe some kind of Prometheus rebel figure. Mm-hmm. So we now have the Earth and space and time, thanks to Ogo the Bad Namo. But he's got a good twin, who I believe is not named in Ogo Tamela's recounting.
Well, that seems like an oversight. If it's if it's a twin and the other one is capable of creating the whole world, what can the twin do?
Well, maybe it's Ogo spelled backwards. Oh, no, wait, that would also be Ogo. Oh. Well, the twin actually redeems the fallen Earth that's full of blight and suffering thanks to Ogo by creating another world, Sigu Tolo.
Oh.
Which, in Ogo Tamela's recounting, the Dogon associate with Sirius, the star Sirius, the okay. brightest star in the night sky, then as now.
Why so serious?
And apparently they have a very complicated system around the brightest star, which would not be unusual in Africa. The Egyptians knew that when Sirius appeared on the horizon, the Nile was about to flood.
Right.
Like we still call it the, you know, the dog days of summer because that's when the dog star appeared low on the horizon. But they called it Sigu Tolo because their festival of Sigu would happen every, I don't know, like 60 years or something when Sirius happened to appear right between these two mountain peaks. Apparently this is local to Ogo Tamela's village. I now realize that mm-hmm. I explain it to you mm-hmm. because those two mountain peaks would not line up with Sirius from every point on Earth.
Right.
It's like in the new Star Wars movie where you have to stand at exactly the right place for the knife to match the whatever the MacGuffin widget
is. Oh, spoiler alert.
Spoilers. Okay. Here, you obviously you've seen the movie Goonies, right?
No, I have not seen the movie Goonies. We go over this every time you mention the movie
Somehow,
Goonies.
You are the only person of your generation who did not see the movie. Well, trust me that a pirate doubloon lines up with Haystack Rock of Cannon Beach.
Come on.
Spoilers.
Jeez.
I just ruined. What do you think is the statute of limitations for Goonies spoilers? Because that movie came out in 1985. That movie's 25 years old.
For me, I feel like I've burbled along because the spoiler era has only been the last, 8 years? There weren't really spoilers before that.
Spoilers didn't exist. You'd walk into a theater and the guy coming out would be like, Darth Vader's his father? What the?
Yeah, that's the only chance. And so I somehow avoided the noid of spoilers.
Well, also everybody saw everything at once because TV shows all aired at once. You wouldn't have to not tell people who shot JR because they were going to watch it 3 weeks later.
Everybody was going to be there. But now I thought that I had passed the Goonies spoiler bubble and I was safe.
You were safe and clear. No, yeah. I'm going to tell you everything that happens in Goonies. But now, forget the Dogon.
How far away would the mountains have to be? I mean, there's a setup, right, where Sirius and the mountains need to be a certain distance, and then you get a larger group of people that could be celebrating this.
That's true.
This situation.
And maybe it's from the place where the festival is. Maybe everybody gathers to the site where the stuff lines up.
Right, because Stonehenge isn't celebrating something that's everywhere. It's celebrating the way the stars and the moon line up at Stonehenge.
That's true. Although things like the equinox, I mean, if you're just talking about direction, I guess it's true. It would have to line up with the actual megaliths or whatever.
But you think about this part of Africa at this time, there's not a lot of light pollution.
That's true.
Not a lot blocking the sky.
No,
it's not like
no urban density.
Right there, it's kind of generally like
if you can move from where the acacia tree or the straw roof or the giraffe is, you can
get a pretty clear view.
I can't see the moon, honey. Just you're behind the giraffe.
You're behind a giraffe again. but the stars would play a much larger role in defining their thoughts than they do for us anymore.
And any kind of navigation you would need for a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. You know, it wouldn't be merely spiritual. It would be functional, too. If you want to make your way back to the village, you got to know where the stars are at which time of night. So Sirius is very important, or Sigu Tolo, as they call it. And in fact, the creation myth goes on. The good twin sends down an ark from heaven with the eight ancestors in it.
So an ark being a ship or an ark being a gold box?
Ark with a K like a ship, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And it's an ark because it has all the seeds and animals, and this is where all the, this is where the giraffes and acacia trees come from. You know, Earth, the once blighted Earth now becomes a good place because the good twin has sent down the ancestral spirits from the planet, from the star Sirius.
Earth 1 becomes Earth 2.
Exactly. Or maybe the other way around.
Uh-huh.
I guess, I think, I'm trying to remember which one is the bad one, where the crime syndicate is the Justice League. Earth 3? Earth S? I don't know.
So this is basically a Gaia bomb that's coming down with the ashes of Spock to terraform.
Right. It's the Genesis torpedo. Right. Yes, exactly.
To terraform like bad former Earth and make it into good, lush Earth.
Let the record indicate that you brought the first Star Trek metaphor
into the conversation. No, that was an accident.
I was fine using Star Wars like a normal person.
I slipped on that Star Trek reference.
And Griol is fascinated by all of this because he loves how this, according to his work, every bit of their culture reflects the centrality of this myth, which he estimates only 5 to 15% of the elders of the population actually understand in totality, this kind of Gnostic wisdom. But yet he sees echoes of this in every single thing they do, all their ceremonies, all their practices, all their dress, all their art. It all comes from this central myth.
Well, and it sounds like there's a priestly class.
Yes. And I guess they would be the ones in his view who guard this knowledge. But you see it in their architecture and everything. And this becomes fascinating to him. And when it's the thesis of his book that this amazing culture preserved from Islam and preserved from the West has managed to reflect their beautiful kind of bizarre and Baroque creation myth in every aspect of their lives. Because if you're an ethnographer, this is the kind of elegance you want to see. You want to impose this beautiful pattern. And this really catches on in French intellectual circles. His book is translated into many languages, from Russian to Japanese. There becomes a brief phase of Dogon mania in Western Europe,
really?
Where artists are producing masks that look like Dogon masks. Everybody loves the architecture. Film is made. And to be clear, a lot of this comes from one of Griol's most surprising results, which are that the Dogon appear to have astronomical and scientific knowledge they should not have, given our assumptions about these backwards African people. You know, he wants to be one of these guys who points out that, no, their culture is as complicated and as valid and as advanced as anything, you know, we would associate with, you know, with the West or with Asia. You know, these are not primitive tribes, but in fact, somehow they know about the moons of Jupiter, for example, despite not having telescopes. They know about the rings of Saturn. The most surprising twist is that
they have great eyesight.
if they're not standing behind a giraffe, they have amazing astronomical knowledge. And most surprisingly, he says that their belief is that Sigu Tolo, Sirius, where the ancestors came from, actually is a triple system. That there's a second world there called Po Tolo, and a third one, a dark one called Emeya Tolo. Now, this actually accords with scientific knowledge that there is Sirius B, there is a double star. We now know from observing the brightness and the perturbations in its orbit or whatever, that Sirius is a double star. Sirius B is a white dwarf. It's not big and it's not bright and it's towards the end of its life, but there is a double star there. How would they have known if not for the Namo?
Maybe they listened to Podcasts. The Grateful Dead.
I thought you were going to say like This American Life.
No.
Maybe they watched Neil deGrasse Tyson memes.
The Grateful Dead knew all about the dark star.
Exactly. And Emeya Tolo, in fact, you know, the idea that there could be a third star is very much an open scientific question. Could there be an unknown brown dwarf there? So as you can imagine, this excites the, what do you call these crypto-archaeologist, ancient astronauts guys of the 70s. And this becomes received wisdom. The Encyclopedia Britannica entry for the Dogon still notes that central to their lore is how 3,000 years ago, aliens came down from Sirius B and taught them the ways of the universe.
Are you saying that this is still in the 1975 copy of the Encyclopedia Britannica that you have in your living room?
This is on the online version of the Britannica that I looked up as I was parking outside your house.
Well, it should be noted that the Dogon are part of the like African mask culture.
Beautiful masks.
Incredible masks that have very unusual sort of... some of the masks almost look like scuba gear
or if you are looking for
a connection between, if you're looking for a visual sort of echo of the idea that they have had UFO contact, their masks don't disabuse you.
I mean, if you've ever seen, you know, kind of our long spindly idea of alien grays, I mean, you compare them to the long faces and the big eyes of African masks, you might think to yourself, whoa, if this wasn't made out of a gourd, if this thing was talking to me and doing the close encounters notes with its hands, this is straight up an alien. And so there's a tourism boom to the Dogon, especially when all these 70s pseudoscientists start extrapolating from Griol's results. And by the way, the most popular is a guy named Robert Temple, who's still alive, by the way. I found his website. In 1976, he publishes The Serious Mystery, New Scientific Evidence of Alien Contact 3,000 Years Ago. And it's all based on Griol's work with the Dogon.
Can you imagine being like living in a Dogon village? You're just doing your Dogon business, and then these people start to show up, like in their safari clothes, like pith helmets and whatnot. Like, we're here.
More Dogon tourists. Show us at the Dogon village.
Show us your secret UFO box. I know you have one.
This is absolutely happening. Jeeps full of, you know, Jeeps and Range Rovers full of Europeans and Americans. Maybe counterculture types are showing up, and they're fascinated, and they want to get to the bottom.
They have their Ghostbusters instruments that are totally fake. They're
now the Omnibus is a academic project that we hope will survive in some kind of status as a time capsule for the future.
Yeah, it's like an old mid-century town idea of putting some stuff into the corner of a bank.
And as a result, it is freely available to all.
That's right.
We do two omnibi a week. So most months have between 8 and 10 new entries in the show.
Provided for you as a public service by Ken and John Enterprise.
Because we believe it's important. A historical purpose is being served.
Correct.
Now, in order to make the show economically viable, we do allow public support via our Patreon. At patreon.com/omnibusproject. If you give at the $5 level, you get a new bonus episode. So instead of 9 or 10 a month, you're getting 10 or 11 a month.
And it's a cool episode. I enjoy making them.
And the thing about a $5 donation is, because you're getting, I mean, what is that, 10 or 11 hours of entertainment?
For $5.
What you really are, you're chipping in 50 cents for each omnibus you listen to, which is honestly, like, I feel a little bad. Like I have a thrifty Mormon voice in my head that says, do not ask other people for money.
True. A lot of us do.
But it's not so bad to say, hey, if you want, the show is free, but if you want to pay 50 cents per show, honestly, for an hour of entertainment, that's a pretty good deal. And
you could pay $1 a show, and that's at the $10 level, and you get an additional bonus at the $10 level, right?
Like if you go to a movie, you're paying
$14.
$14 for I mean, 2 hours of entertainment. Let's be honest.
All right, but that's $7.
It's still
$7
an hour. We're offering a much better rate. We love all our listeners, but we offer a special thanks to those who support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Right. Think of it that way. If you gave $14 a month, it would just be like going to see one movie a month.
What's better? Some crappy movie or like 10 hours of me and John talking about our junior high memories? It's no contest.
No contest.
Robert Temple, by the way, is an interesting guy. I spent way too much time, more than I should, on his website. I believe he's still alive, and it seems to be teaching in Beijing. He recently is now some kind of actual professor of archaeology at, teaching tenures in four different countries, including the University of Louisville. I know that's not a country. But his website is full of fascinating cases of stories of him meeting famous folks from the 20th century. If you want to know about how he met Salvador Dali or Howdy Doody, Pearl Buck.
Joe, you ever seen Dali and Howdy Doody in the same place?
They weren't together, I don't think. Joan Rivers, and an amazing story about how he was always hanging out with Tallulah Bankhead when he was young, and she sure would walk around naked all the time.
Huh.
But don't worry, she wasn't molesting him like all those other young boys said. She was only into lesbians and 10% of the time, large black men.
This sounds like a great website.
I suddenly became more interested in Tallulah Bankhead's late in life relationship with Estelle Winwood than I was in Dogon Culture and Ancient Astronauts. But anyway, so Robert Temple is one of these guys like von Däniken who possibly influenced by Lovecraft, mm-hmm. by this idea that the universe was full of dark eldritch forces, mm-hmm. you know, who were leaving evidence in our ruins, you know, was looking for evidence of this stuff in, like you say, the Nazca lines and the
right.
whatever the chalk drawings on the British Downs are. So this goes from Encyclopedia Britannica entry to worldwide bestseller. The Dogon have received alien visitors from some planet orbiting Sirius.
Now the thing that always irked me, or not irked me, but let's say irked me. No, not irked.
I like how you didn't irked. Want to use such a strong word as irked.
Look, I don't want to go on record as having been irked.
You know what really rings my beach towel, Ken?
But it always seems like some of the like for UFOs to have come to the world and to have imparted such esoteric knowledge to the Dogon as that there are two other stars orbiting around Sirius, but not to have given them anything else, really. No, they like didn't give them the can opener or...
And just a couple thousand miles away, they're giving the Egyptians anti-gravity power to levitate the pyramid blocks.
Yeah, like it just seems like such a strange little gift to give sitting around the campfire. Like, you guys, guess what? Sirius has two other stars around it. Okay, peace out. And, you know, and they're like, well, wait, like, couldn't you give us like one more kind of seed that grows in the desert? Yeah. Like, no. what about one other game that we could play? It's kind of boring out here. Like,
we keep chewing these branches and they have big thorns. Could you tell us how to get rid of the thorns?
Yeah, some drugs,
nope,
maybe.
Jupiter has 3 to 4 large moons.
Like baseball, just like one other cool thing.
Maybe, you know, just to, you know, play devil's advocate for Marcel Griel here, maybe okay. he would say that, you know, all that was lost, all the firsthand stuff that they just happened to get in conversation with the UFOs.
Well, see, now this is the thing that this is where the irkage happens, because
I'm blaming the Dogons.
That's right. It intrinsically suggests that the Dogons are not smart enough to have actually gathered any technology that was useful.
Maybe they're just not good listeners.
See, I believe that the Dogon probably are great listeners, because what else is there to do when the sun goes down?
In this conventional wisdom that's now appearing in best-selling books all over the world is hardly slowed down at all when Griel is posthumously taken down in the 1980s by another ethnographer, this one Dutch. So we now have a sober Dutchman on the case.
That's
not
good.
Not a flighty Frenchman.
Good news.
He strolls,
you know, softly into the scene.
Walter van Beek, starting in 1979, made 9 separate visits to the Dogon people, trying to do a follow-up.
Until they couldn't wait to see him.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Here comes Van
the
Beek.
The Dutch guy. Let's tell him it was all bull. And he publishes in the – interesting, when I saw Walter van Beek's name, I was like, why do I know this guy? It turns out, unlike most Dutch ethnographers at the top – religious ethnographers at the top of their field, he is Mormon.
Really?
Weirdly.
But from the Netherlands.
From the Netherlands. Some kind of a convert, I guess.
Interesting.
Two kids from Idaho knocked on his door one day. And he was a religious ethnographer. So he's like, whoa.
Wow.
You guys come in. I'm going to get my tape recorder. Anyway, I don't know if that makes – maybe this makes him less reliable to you. But as a sober Dutchman who is also a chaste and sober-minded Mormon.
That's 3 levels of sobriety.
This guy's going to give us the real story.
So had you heard of him because he is present in the pantheon of great Mormons?
I think he's written – I don't know. I could look right now. But I think he's done religious scholarship because he's both an expert on comparative religion and, you know, a practicing – Latter-day Saint.
Right. So you may have read him.
Yes. I think I may have read whatever his internet work is that's, you know, Mormon-centric and not. But this is what I think this is what he's most known for in the secular world is his work with the Dogon people.
Well, now I really want to know what he's known for in the Mormon world. Why do we get excluded?
Sorry, that's only for 5 to 15% of the initiates who get to know Walter van Beek's secret good work. No, in his groundbreaking work on the Dogons, he finds that, you know, basically Greil was completely out to lunch. That his two main findings, first of all, are that the Dogons do not even have a creation myth. There's that, you know, the broad strokes are there. You know, they do believe in water spirits called Namo that are kind of catfish looking, you know, animist spirits of the pond or whatever, but there's no Ogo. Ogo is just their word for elder. There's no, divining fox. A lot of Marcel Greil's work revolves around a pale fox that knows all the secrets of the universe and gets created at some point.
Behold a pale fox.
Right. It's very, very much some Carlos Castaneda thing that sounds like it's right of that time.
So was this just the one guy just gaslighting him with some totally made up stuff, or was Marceau actually the source of the lie?
Do you believe that Marcel Marceau, the famous mime, was actually in on the conspiracy?
Like always.
You know, he's not going to talk. That's the guy you should tell your secret religious knowledge.
You know, if you look at Marcel Marceau and compare him to some of these African masks, you'll see a through line.
He's not trapped in a box. He's in a force field.
Yeah.
He's in an airlock.
He's trapped in the box of our prior knowledge of the world.
Yeah. So Van Beek has his own theories about what he does not believe Greil is a charlatan.
Greil. Sorry. I don't know why I was calling him Marcel.
Well, his first name is Marcel. So you were not wrong.
I was still wrong.
You were less wrong. He can't find any mention of Sirius B. There's no secret initiatory knowledge about any of this stuff that only the elders have.
But they still do female circumcision.
Unfortunately,
yes. That part is not. Well, if one of this.
All the cool stuff is gone.
If some part of this story is a lie, why can it be that?
It's a bummer, right? Like, it turns out Ogo is just an elder. Instead of a pale fox, they believe that, you know, the foxes have no more special knowledge than any of the bush animals. They hold that, you know, some kind of ancestral spirit knowledge is in all living things. But nothing specific about that.
That's pretty reductive. I think the foxes know different things than the giraffes.
You're so mad at the animists. And there's no Namo twins, one of which is a destroyer and one of which is a redeemer.
So where did all this come from?
In fact, religion does not appear to be especially central to their lives.
There isn't even a priestly class.
There are, you know, the Greil's take is that everything about their society, you know, they hold twins to be sacred. This kind of ties in Biafran twins or whatever it is. And blacksmiths are sacred because that has origins in how the world gets made. And
still true to this day.
Right? They're so sacred, we don't even have them anymore. Griots, the storyteller bard types, are held in high esteem because of reflections in the story. Van Beek can find no evidence of any of this.
Now, how does Van Beek know that he's not being gaslit?
I'm sure this is what there are people, all the ancient alien crystal skull vodka people, including Greil's descendants, his daughter, pushed back at Van Beek saying, oh no, you didn't get the good stuff. Obviously they trusted daddy more and pulled pulled the wool over your eyes. So,
but they could totally be a trickster culture where every single time a Western person shows up,
they just
like,
tell a different story.
Come here, I'll tell you.
It's like an improv exercise. Okay. Christian, you tell me a funny place where two people might meet. That is their take. And actually that's not too different than what Van Beek thinks happens. Their love of harmony is so important that they are people pleasers. If somebody shows up with preconceptions about what a West African tribe would believe, Van Beek points out that a lot of this stuff about a mystical energy binding everything together, the force basically, it comes from mana, an idea that was very much in vogue in French ethnography at the time. And Greil really wanted to see this there. And so he did.
Wow.
He set up, apparently in Van Beek's account, he set up his research station very much like a military base camp. He was not concerned about since you brought up Star Trek, he was not concerned with the Prime Directive.
Uh-huh.
He was willing to just send all his guys out there with a mission and tell them, here's what you need to get for me. And so these poor Dogon are dealing with Frenchmen showing up being like, hey, in Van Beek's account, they are just, they're still, you know, decades later, there's still memory of all this. Everybody remembers the blind guy he talked to. Everybody remembers all the crazy questions. And to Van Beek, the vibe is more like, they thought we were going to have a name for everything. They wanted to know what every single cricket was called. And so we told them. Like, they'd be like, well, what's that dung beetle called? Well, that's a dung beetle. Yeah, but what's that one called? And they'd look at each other and be like, that's the hyena dung beetle.
Fred.
What's that one called? Oh, that's the donkey dung beetle. Like, nobody wanted to tell them that, you know, they love Harmony so much, nobody wanted to say, like, buddy, that's the same dung beetle. So they just made stuff up.
What's wonderful is that so much cultural anthropology is just this. It's why it's a discredited science, right?
You can't just talk to one blind guy for 30 days and then write the Encyclopedia Britannica entry. Like, I'm sure he's a delightful man.
Oh, he's amazing. He's amazing. I love this. And, the European guys are like, so, did someone tell you about the third star of Sirius? And they're like, oh, yes.
Yeah.
The special friend.
They're just lucky that no one said, is there a fourth star of Sirius? Because they would have been like, oh, sure. That's where the two-headed giraffes are.
I love it.
And the French people are all looking at their notes, so they can't see the Dogon shooting each other looks like,
right.
I don't know.
Right.
The other thing about the Dogon is apparently they're very they're innovative. They're I don't know if I want to say imitative. They're not necessarily one of these Star Trek cultures that gets one book about Gangland Chicago and decides to remake the whole planet. But they are very prone to what Van Beek calls historical punctuation. You know, as soon as the tourists started coming in the 60s and 70s and they saw new agricultural methods, when Van Beek came back, he saw them using all the agricultural methods that they had seen from the visitors.
Wait a minute. What tourists to West Africa are bringing agriculture with?
There must have been humanitarian stuff with the with the eyeball of the world.
It wasn't just like a tourist family that just immediately started plowing around there.
We could put sorghum here. And for example, Van Beek points out that they have a story exactly like the story in Genesis 9 about Noah getting drunk and his daughters seeing him naked. And when they're asked, you know, this just must have come from missionaries, they're like, oh, no, we had it way before them. And
but again, if their cosmology is going to like adopt some stories from Christianity, why the one about Noah getting naked with his daughters? That's like not really.
Isn't that all you remember from the book of Genesis?
That's not at the front of the canon.
I bet there's a bunch of stuff you've forgotten from the Bible, but the guy who gets naked and his daughters all see, I bet that's what you would remember.
I have the Bible greatest hits.
You have the bonobo translation of the Bible. The bonobo. And so it's a combination of them being people pleasers, them being quick to adopt innovation, and then just the confrontational style of Griol's researchers like, hey, no, you got to tell me more. Like, you haven't told me the real deal. And that extends to the astronomical knowledge. So one of the most common critiques of Griol's work, which astronomers like Carl Sagan, in fact, made, was that their astronomical knowledge reflected pretty much the state of European scientific astronomy at the time Griol visited. A second Sirius star was already known and had been since the 1890s. And so he finds that. There had been a theory that maybe there was a third, much less bright brown dwarf star orbiting Sirius as well. And wow, shocker, he finds evidence of that as well. Now, since then, unfortunately, that theory about a third star has been pretty well debunked.
That discredits the Dogon.
The Dogon thought they were so smart, standing behind giraffes and looking at the sky. You're exactly right. The theory now is that although a brown dwarf would have been one explanation for this, now they think it's some background object, visible behind Sirius that is giving us these weird, whatever the variations in brightness or whatever.
So in this case, Sirius is the giraffe.
Yes. They were just looking behind Sirius the whole time. So, you know, it may be the unfortunate case that Dogon did not have secret wisdom imparted. They're lovely, but it just means, like many of us, they did not have secret wisdom imparted by ancient aliens in 1000 BC, and that's okay.
Well, speak for yourself. And that concludes The Dogon, entry 369.DE0419, certificate number 26731 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that ancient aliens have appeared before you with a complex sort of piecemeal patchwork.
Yeah, like a Trivial Pursuit card. One Trivial Pursuit card. You guys get to know six things.
Where it's like, all right, here's what we're going to give you guys.
I guess that actually could be what proves us wrong here. If the ancient, I mean, for one thing, is if Sirius C is discovered. if M.A. Yatolu exists, then boy, are our faces going to be red. But also, what if the aliens come back?
Well, here's my ancient alien theory. What if they gave each one of these contacted groups one piece of the puzzle? And it's only it's only when there is a United Nations of peoples who have had ancient contact with aliens, when they all gather together and each person puts their little stone key into the key box.
Isn't this basically the plot of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull?
I don't remember that movie. It was so awful that I blocked it out. But yeah, what if there's something where, you know, where we just need Nicolas Cage to like find the box where all the stone keys fit.
Well, I hope you have done that, futurelings. I hope you have done this It's a Mad, 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 Mad World search all over the world with the Inca skull and the Sumerian tablet and the Babylonian ingot. And I hope you put them all together.
And then it unlocks the door to what? Zul.
It opens the Dogon door, exactly. Maybe it's a time portal. Maybe they were from the future.
Well,
maybe they were future Frenchmen.
Futurelings, there will not be any Frenchmen in the future.
Why not? They live forever. They drink a glass of red wine every day.
No, little by little, they're going to get transformed. France is going to get terraformed and turned into another Germany.
By Spock's casket? Sorry about the noise. I'm opening the mail. I don't know if this is showing up on mic, but I'm opening a very noisy padded envelope.
Yeah, I thought we waited to open the mail for our Patreon-funded mail opening episode.
Well, we can describe what we get. The photos only show up on Patreon, but
I feel like people are sending us cool things, but there should be more envelopes of cash.
I like how this is your one complaint about the mail.
Where are the envelopes of cash?
This is the person that sent us the trivia question about Lena Wertmüllerig, and
they've sent us a much larger package.
This is a three-step treasure hunt. Is this going to take us to the hidden knowledge?
Well, yeah, where's the stone key in this? Whoa, that envelope is full of envelopes.
Dawn thanks us for putting color back into her life.
Uh-huh.
And now
welcome, Dawn.
Now she is sending us new Pacific Northwest history about the streets of Bothell, Washington.
Whoa.
Have you ever been to Lazy Husband Road?
That's one of history's mysteries.
I have never been to Lazy Husband Road, apparently.
No, but when we're done here, we can get into the literal omnibus and drive over to,
to
Lazy
check it
Husband
out.
Road. Oh, we each got an envelope with our name written on it.
You should do the post office box and stuff.
Wait a minute. This says John Paren Jeopardy end Paren.
Well, I think we're going to have to play a little Jeopardy here. Isn't this? She always does the quizzes, remember?
Oh, I see. She's got a little game going.
And then there's she's like you know, the dead guy in Clue or Sleuth or whatever. I assume she's not dead.
There's a lot happening here. This is sealed with a little blue ribbon.
I think
look.
Oh, you're
it's an envelope full of cash.
I've never seen you happier.
Oh my God, there are five $1 bills in here, although she did not face her bills. I mean, they're all facing the same way, but they're not. Oh,
well, maybe you just open the envelope upside down.
No.
There's no true north in an envelope.
No, but I'm saying they weren't faced with relative to
other.
One another.
Oh, okay.
Boy, I can't. That's really hard for me to bear.
So when people send you money, your OCD kicks in before your greed and narcissism.
Well, no, I saw the greed. I was excited about the money, but then when the bills were unfaced, it's like hard to do. Oh, okay. So
I think you have the answer and I have the question.
Yeah. So should we play this? Should we play this game right now on air?
Sure. If Futurelings, if you want to sell us your diabolical games from beyond the grave, send them to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. I have a picture of a local fantasy author that says, "This modern knight was a prolific author with over 100 publications, including collaborations with Neil Gaiman and Stephen Baxter." And I believe it's Terry Pratchett. He's got a hat, and I think Terry Pratchett always wore a hat. So I'm going to say the answer is, who is Terry Pratchett?
Terry Pratchett is the correct answer. Ding, 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 ding.
Does that mean
ding,
you have
ding.
To hand over? You only got your five unfaced dollars for 30 seconds.
If Ken answers correctly, please distribute the $5, if not the $5, is mine. So the $5, I'm distributing it apparently to you, and now it's face.
This is the only kind of distribution I enjoy.
So I took the bad luck away.
It's when.
Oh, well, that's super frustrating for me.
I don't know if anyone else wants to listen to us do this game show, but I like it every time I win $5.
Terry Pratchett. Well, you know, one time I think I got the money.
You did, because I think I got it wrong, or did you get it right?
I'm not sure.
But she also sent us a copy of a Terry Pratchett book. That's very nice.
Oh, that's nice. She suggests that your daughter may be too old, but my daughter might be a little young.
My daughter is listening to It on audiobook, which terrifies. It's not terrifying her, but it terrifies me.
It scares me just to hear the name read aloud.
She's definitely going to start swearing more.
You know, there could stand to be a little more swearing around your house. Let me just throw that out there.
We're all wearing our identically colored polo shirts.
I'm just saying.
We're doing a wholesome arts and crafts around the dining room table.
You know, it's pretty screwed down over there.
We don't say screwed.
Ugh.
We say tamped.
Anyway, futurelings, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are all basically flawless new civilizations. Where ancient aliens in the form of people Ken's and my age have appeared and imparted a whole bunch of confusing knowledge.
Or even older if it's Facebook.
That's right. Facebook, people that are our parents' age, the truly ancient aliens, have brought their unwelcome wisdom. And now it's being sort of chopped up and made even more confusing by a game of telephone. So that basically it has just precipitated war with Iran. It's basically a Facebook war. No, we're not at war with Iran.
Well, this won't air for a couple months. I would not go on the record with that one.
But if you want to know what Ken and I are thinking, you can go to @KenJennings and @JohnRoderick at any of those spots. You can go to Omnibus Futurelings on Facebook. You can watch me live my glamorous and heavily edited life on Instagram.
Exciting globe-trotting life.
You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can send us quizzes of your own construction.
As long as there's a cash prize, we will always do the quiz.
That's right. Envelopes full of money at P.O. Box 55744 Shoreline, Washington 98155. And if you enjoy the show, we would appreciate your support on Patreon. That's patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Listeners, from our vantage point here in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization will survive. We hope the ancient aliens return and prove us wrong about the Dogon. That they not only do they show up in Central Mali and are like, "Hey, what's up?" And everybody still knows the elaborate fist bump thing. That's the instead of the close encounters hand signals, there's just an elaborate fist bump. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, or it may hold off until the alien portal opens. But if the worst comes soon, this very recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, if the Namo Water Spirit Twins allow, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.